Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen, and I'm joined right now by Senator Gary Peters, who's in town viewing some of the damage that was caused by our June 17th storm and the resulting flood. Senator, first, thank you for making the trip up here.
Oh, great to be with you, Rick, as always.
Now, you just completed that tour, took a few stops in Houghton, Ripley. We went over to Hubble, Lake Linden. You got a kind of a nice broad view of things that were going on. Your impression of what you saw?
Well, I think the first impression is just the level of devastation that occurred, and remarkably, in such a short period of time. You know, that's the thing that struck me. Certainly, I woke up, looked at the pictures downstate as to what happened up here, was just literally, as I mentioned, jaw-dropping kind of photographs of the damage of roads and infrastructure that occurred with roughly about an hour's worth of rainfall, but a whole lot of rain in that 1 hour. So I wanted made sure to come up here, particularly given the fact in the U.S. Senate, I serve on the Homeland Security Committee, is one of my Senate responsibilities, and I'm the ranking member on the subcommittee that oversees FEMA. And certainly FEMA has been up here, but I wanted to have a chance to come up, see the damage directly, and then I'm going to be working very closely to make sure FEMA does what they need to do to help the community get through this.
Does that position give you any leverage? Does it put us in an advantage point so that we can get that federal declaration of disaster area?
Well, the federal declaration is done, or two things are critically important. One is the evaluation as to the extent of damage. There's a Stafford Act that actually outlines that by law as to when you qualify for FEMA federal money assistance. We don't have the numbers yet. We're waiting for those, but I think it sounds as if you will qualify for assistance. And so then it's up to the president as to whether or not the president declares this a federal emergency zone. So I will certainly be writing and reaching out to the administration in a very strong way that this should get that federal disaster declaration. We'll enlist my colleagues in the Congress as well to do that. But I think where my position on the subcommittee that oversees FEMA will be important is the fact that we oversee FEMA, so they will always take my call, which is important, and make sure that once that declaration is made, if it is made, and I believe it will be, then we'll make sure that they're acting as quick as possible. And for me, I think that's the thing that I'm going to really be focused on, and it was certainly very evident today when you look at the extent of the damage that has been done. It's going to take significant reconstruction. That's time-consuming. But the one thing we don't have up here is time, because winter is always fairly nearby, and we're just a couple months away from the construction season ending. So this is something that has to happen very quickly.
The other thing we don't have is money. And in a lot of these small municipalities, the amount of damage that was done in their local area would be the equivalent of their yearly budget for 10 years.
Right.
I mean, there is no way for local governments to be able to pay to put this, you know, put the Copper Country back anywhere back to where it was.
No, that's absolutely right, Rick. You know, we had on the tour, as you know, and you joined us, which I appreciate. We had a number of township supervisors, and they talked about their annual budget of $200,000 or $300,000 a year, and yet they're looking at several million dollars worth of damage in their community. So certainly the state of Michigan needs to step up, and there's always matching funds whenever there's federal money. So the state of Michigan needs to take a very strong lead role, but hopefully the federal government will be able to provide additional assistance.
We've been providing information for private homeowners so that they kind of know what's coming. There's, you know, the misconception that the federal government was going to come in and then pay for all of their damages. And that got started, and everybody kind of knew at the beginning, or at least as we were talking, that's not the way FEMA works. Or there may be money made available through different kinds of loans, or maybe some grant money available from various sources. We know that Ty was sitting next to Portage Health Foundation Director Kevin Storr on that tour, and he was explaining to me how, you know, they're going to be distributing the over $3 million that they may have or expect to have for private homeowners. Well, can you explain to the audience why FEMA doesn't provide help for homeowners as far as like how they reimburse the municipalities?
Well, and FEMA can help individual homeowners. It depends on the extent of the damage. And again, it's a criteria. It's a template, and so it depends on how many homes in numbers have been destroyed relative to the population as well. So it doesn't disadvantage a rural area versus urban areas, but it's a formula, and it's uncertain. And I don't know what those numbers will be. It's possible that we'll cross that. They have not shared those assessment numbers because they're still scrubbing the numbers to make sure they're accurate before any information is put out. So we don't know if they'll qualify, but if they don't qualify, you won't have federal money available. It'll be up to the state of Michigan whether or not they're going to provide any assistance to individual homeowners.
What's the time frame that we can expect for all this to take place, knowing that work needs to be started relatively soon, and as we were talked about, there are local governments that don't have the money to write the check to begin that work?
Yeah, I think first you got to get the disaster declaration. That's going to be up to the president. One, well, first off, we have to get the numbers. And then if the numbers are such that the area qualifies for public assistance, which means through roads and infrastructure, then the governor will make a request of the federal government, or a request to the president, and the president needs to make a decision. I would hope that would be done quickly. I'm certainly going to do everything I can to push that forward and to urge the administration to act quickly. If they do that, then FEMA can begin their operations. And it may, money may not flow right away, but once you have been dedicated, or once that declaration has been made, the communities will be given instructions. They can contract work knowing that there will be money to help pay for it. And that's where, back to your question, Rick, about my position as a ranking member on the Senate committee that oversees FEMA, that's what I will use that position to say, we got to get this done quickly. And, hopefully within 30 days, you could actually start seeing some money getting to the state. I think it's also important for your listeners to know it all goes through the state. Even when the federal government doesn't pay money directly to a local municipality, it'll be paid to the state, and the state will be the one directing the operations.
You mentioned a couple of times that the decision is up to the president. Does that mean that President Trump himself will be making this decision, or is there somebody under him that makes this decision?
Well, I'm not sure. Ultimately, it's his decision. I'm sure he has. I know he'll have staff that will review it and make a recommendation to him, and then he'll make his decision based on that recommendation.
Okay. It's all in his hands then,
right? It is. First, we got to get the governor to request it, and that comes from the evaluation. But I'm encouraged by what I'm hearing that it does meet the qualification.
Okay, let's switch gears and talk about some of the other things that you have going on. One of the movements that we've had here in funding has been for the Sioux Locks, and this is something that we have talked, you and I have talked about, yeah, for a number of years, trying to get that project done. And it seems that recently there has been some positive movement in making that happen.
There has. And in fact, I think I sat here just about 2 months ago talking about this when I was up here for the Michigan Tech commencement, as you know. And at that time, I said we're waiting for a report to come back from the Army Corps of Engineers, which looks at the cost-benefit analysis of the construction of a second lock. I mentioned I was very confident it would come back saying that this is needed, and I'm happy to say that is exactly what happened. The Army Corps just put out their report last week that stated that the cost of a shutdown of the locks would be dramatic. It would be catastrophic for the economy as well if a shutdown lasted for a couple months. It wouldn't just be bad for Michigan or the Midwest. It could actually cause a recession around the country because of the economic impact of a lock that's shut down. And that's a similar type of finding to the Department of Homeland Security. And basically what the Army Corps did this time, which they didn't last time, and they will freely admit it was a mistake, is that they didn't factor in the fact that if the Sioux Locks aren't operating, there's really no other way to get those raw materials down south. There's not enough rail cars. There's not enough semi-trucks to do it. And so it is truly a piece of critical infrastructure.
Do we have a target date on when we can start seeing that renovation taking place?
Well, there isn't. The report came back that it's necessary, but that it competes with other reports that also show that there's critical infrastructure. But this now puts us on the list. We weren't even on the list before, so that's a very positive movement. But you still need to have it appropriated. The cost that they estimated, it was about $900 million, so close to, it will not be a cheap project, but it is critical infrastructure.
Wow. So who has to approve that money?
Well, it's the Congress, ultimately, but certainly the Army Corps gets a budget every year. They prioritize projects, but the fact that we have this report will help our efforts. There's no question about it.
All right. You've also been pushing the for CTE education as well. You continue to do that. We've talked again about that before. I want to see if there was an update on that effort.
Well, there is, and I appreciate you bringing up. Career technology or tech education is critical. There's a shortage of workers that have that are skilled workers, whether it's in construction trades or having skills that have to work in manufacturing. These are programs that are not a two-year degree program. They're not four-year degree programs. This is traditional skills training. Sometimes a matter of weeks, sometimes months, sometimes a year or so. And they lead immediately to good-paying jobs. We've got to expand those programs. But quite frankly, we just have to get more young people and others, adults as well, to get into these programs and to realize that these are great careers going forward. And that we have a shortage of these folks. In fact, I just did a company last week, two companies that have several openings in terms of, you add them both up, I think it was over 100 openings they have for people with specific skills when it comes to on the manufacturing floor and understanding how manufacturing works and some of the applications of that. And if you had those skills, you would get a job instantly. And so legislation that I've authored, I'm happy to say, has now passed out of the Senate committee as part of an education bill. Will help school counselors have the tools that they need to talk to students about how these are great careers. You don't have to go to a four-year college. You don't have to have a two-year community school degree. Those are certainly great if you want to do that. But there are a number of career options that require certificate training, and that certificate training is often available at a community college or perhaps union apprenticeship programs that are available that have openings. And those jobs lead to great careers, good pay, and very fulfilling jobs. And so this is about making sure that when a student goes into counseling, that they're not told just some options. They're told all of the options that are available to them as they think about their future career and things that they're excited about and what they might want to do to make a living.
My daughter, who is attending college right now, when we go and look at financial aid options, you know, there's the Pell Grant, there's student loans, those types of things to make it easier for her to pursue a four-year degree. Do those same options, are they available for somebody that wants to get into a trades education? Can they qualify for federally backed student loans? Can they get those same kind of Pell Grants?
Not the same kind of Pell Grants, and unfortunately there's a limited amount of money, which is part of the problem, which is the next step. We have to have counseling services, which we got passed recently, but you need to have resources to make sure that students can actually afford the tuition for these programs. But it depends on which track you go. If you're in a union, for example, and there are apprenticeship programs, there's no cost. It's training. The union will train you. You'll be an apprentice and a journeyman. And get a good paying job at the other end of it. That's a great option. And most of the skilled trade unions here in Michigan have openings for apprentice. It's something that folks should check out as a great career opportunity. If you go to some of the training programs in a two-year program, let's say at a community college, oftentimes Pell Grants are tied to that two-year program and some of the curriculum associated with that. I think we need to refine that, and I'm working on ways right now where you could get perhaps a Pell Grant or something similar to that for a certificate program that would lead to a job. And, you know, an example, welding. Welding, if you are a skilled welder and have a certificate in welding, you're pretty much guaranteed a job. People are looking for welders right now. And so how do we provide more resources for students who may not be able to afford that training, especially if if it's full-time training and it's hard to have a job, they have a family, you know, that's a difficult thing to do. You need some assistance, and yet you know those folks are going to immediately walk out and have a good-paying job. So I've been working on those as well.
All right. Looking forward to hearing updates of that coming down the road. So let's talk about some fun stuff that's been in the news.
All right.
This past weekend, there was a march across our Portage Lake Lift Bridge in support of families at the border. Mm-hmm. Okay. This has been going on now. Of course, it's been headline news now for a couple of weeks. And it's one of those tough situations where, depending on where you're getting your news from, you're going to get a completely different story. So I took it upon myself to do what most people should do, is do some personal research, try to find out what's going on, mm-hmm. make a have enough information to make a decision, an informed decision on what's going on. And you are as close as I'm probably going to be able to get to this situation, because I don't think I'm ever going to have the president sitting across me on this table. So
you should ask him.
it's a standing invitation, actually. What is going on? Let's just start with the separation of children from their families. Where did this come about?
And as you research, it's complicated. But if you have someone coming across the border and they're an asylum seeker, if they are seeking asylum because of persecution for the country they were before, they were not separated from their family. They were put in some sort of community housing with their families because they're asylum seekers. There's been a change in policy, though, from the president, that anybody who comes across the border now on an undocumented basis, even if they're claiming asylum, that they're now considered in violation of the law, so they're put into a detention facility while they await a hearing, which could be quite some time before that happens. There was a court case, though, when it says that anybody that comes across across the border and are in an undocumented basis, that their children can't be in the detention facility with them, that they need to be held in some place that is not prison-like, but in a community or foster care type situation. So that's what's happening, is that as these folks are coming across, they're put in detention facilities, and then their children are taken away from them and sent to other facilities. And that's what we're seeing right now. It's a change in the policy, in the fact that asylum seekers aren't being treated like they were in the past, as someone who is looking for a court adjudication as to whether or not they should be treated as a refugee, basically.
Well, what makes the distinction between somebody that is coming to the U.S. seeking asylum as opposed to somebody that is attempting to cross the border illegally?
Well, someone who is crossing illegally is just trying to get into the United States to get a job or to cross to be here, and so they're not alleging that they are being targeted or persecuted because of who they are in their country, which would be, that's how you get political asylum, or if you're the victim or perceived the victim of gang violence, for example, and you're being targeted and you need to seek asylum in the United States because you fear for your life in the country that you're in, that would be an example of an asylum seeker, as opposed to someone who's just coming across the border because they want to get a job here in the United States. So that they don't file for asylum. They are just coming across in an undocumented way, and they would be detained. That's what happens. They get detained if they're caught.
And if I understand then correctly, the zero tolerance policy is that if you're attempting to come into the country in any other ways than the normal legal way of applying, then you are treated as if you were coming in illegally first and
right.
put in an detention center. So right. that is the, when they say no or zero tolerance, it's because whether you were trying to come in through a port of entry or through just crossing the border, if you have not gone through the steps to come into the country, you're treated as if you were trying to come into the country illegally.
Yes, I think that's an accurate portrayal. That would be that process, if you're coming without the proper documents, a visa or whatever it may be.
Okay, so it's a misdemeanor to try to enter the country illegally, but right. if you're treating it as a crime, and then you're going to put the parents in some sort of holding, detention center, whatever it is, until awaiting the legal process, we obviously don't put children in a jail, so we put them somewhere else. And that becomes a separation?
Yes, that would be a separation. So they're not in a detention facility, so they are separated. Now, what normally happens would be, if in the United States, for example, if you have a parent who has a child and they're brought into jail for a criminal violation, the children will be put into foster care. But normally you have family members. The idea is not to keep them anywhere separated as well. You want to have them in a loving household. So it'd be a aunt or uncle or a cousin or whatever, or grandparent, whatever it may be. That's obviously usually not the case when you have someone who's coming across the border, doesn't have family members here in the United States. And so children are put into facilities. I was just recently at the facility here in Michigan. It's run by Bethany Christian Services. They deal with unaccompanied minors who come across the border just unaccompanied. We have an issue where we just have children that walk across the border as well that are trying to leave their country. And if they are apprehended by Border Patrol, they will go into foster services like Bethany Christian Service, which the one facility, or with the folks, or with their one facility they have here in Michigan is in the Grand Rapids area. They have currently 60, when I was there last week, they have 60 children who were separated by their parents by the government. The government took the children from the parents and sent them to Bethany Christian Services. That organization is doing everything they can to get them back to the parents because they felt pretty strongly that children should not be separated from their parents, particularly if they have no place to go with another loving home. In fact, they had one child there that was 3 months old. I think most of us are pretty appalled by the fact that a three-month-old baby would be taken from her mother and put into Christian Services. So it's an effort to try to reunite and figure out a way that we can at least reunite parents with their children. You can imagine the trauma. One of a parent being separated from your child is an incredibly traumatic experience. If you're a child being pulled away from your parents in a foreign country where you don't speak the language, that is an absolutely terrifying experience. One question that I asked when I was there is, do you know where the parents are for these children? And to Bethany's credit, they actually know where all the parents are. They know the detention facilities they're in, but they did say they had to go to great lengths to get that information. It wasn't provided to them by the government, but they know. And then I asked, do they have any contact with their parents? And they said they try to get a phone call in, sometimes daily. However, depending on where the parent is, the Department of Homeland Security sometimes does not allow the children to talk to the parents, except perhaps maybe once a week. And I think that's unacceptable.
The claim has been made that this policy dates back to the previous administration. And I've seen several sources that said that that's a misdirection and that it's not accurate. Could you explain that?
Well, no. I mean, the policy, the zero tolerance policy, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, we treat as asylum seekers were treated differently. Now that's not the case. And that was a decision that the current administration made. And now he's reversed that. He did an executive order to reverse a previous order. So that tells you that, you know, before he said the president said he didn't have any authority to do it. And then suddenly he did have the authority to back it up. And so that's just simply not the case.
You started off when you were explaining this, by saying it was a complicated issue. And it is a complicated one, because beyond all of this, there still remains an issue of we have a problem at our borders. And that's it. You know, what do you do with an influx of people coming into the country illegally? The solutions just kind of sort of run the gamut, but, you know, getting everybody to try to agree on what could be done about border security and still, you know, keep America being the welcoming, immigrant-friendly place that, you know, I like to believe it always has been. Where do you stand on that? And, you know, if there's a magic solution to this, you know, what do you think it would, you know, we should be moving towards?
I'm a member of the Senate Homeland Security Committee. This is something we spend a lot of time thinking about. And I'll just say, first and foremost, we must have strong, secure borders. There's no question. Border security has to be the top of the list. You know, any government has to be able to protect its borders and control the flow of people and material that go back and forth across those borders. And so I'm all about secure borders and making sure that our border protection folks have the funding that they need to keep those borders secure. But, you know, that's got to be first and foremost as far as the policy. When it comes to immigration policy, there's a mechanism to do that. And people need to follow those laws.
Senator, I know you have to run. Thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to be with you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.